This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin researcher shares an ongoing project aimed at creating cells that could help people who have suffered vision loss. Now the U.S. government's outstanding debt is projected to reach its statutory limit, its debt ceiling, as of tomorrow. It's according to a letter that Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen sent to Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy last week. If Congress doesn't increase the debt limit, the U.S. could default on the debt, which could have a lot of serious consequences here in the U.S. and around the world. The way things work, Congress has a few months to deal with it. Will they? Republican Wisconsin Representative Mike Gallagher from the state's 8th Congressional District was on WPR's The Morning Show earlier today.
Letting it default would have a bad impact on our credibility globally. It would have a negative economic impact. So that's certainly not an outcome anybody wants to see. But it requires both sides to come to the table in good faith, right?
We're looking at the debt ceiling, the politics surrounding it, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Basics, do you have questions about the national debt, about the debt ceiling and how it works, why it exists in the first place? We'll get into that. And do you think Republicans should use this debt ceiling increase as leverage for particular funding cuts, policy changes, you name it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Stephen Smith is the Kate M. Gregg Distinguished Professor of Social Sciences and Professor of Political Science at Washington University. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you.
Can you explain this debt ceiling concept? What is it? Why is it there?
The debt is, of course, the accumulated borrowing that the federal government is engaged in. There's a limit under federal law on the total amount of borrowing that the federal government has outstanding. This is acquired because in any given year, in recent decades, almost every year, Congress has put in place spending and revenue policies that lead to a deficit. That is, we spend more than we bring in taxes and other forms of revenue, creating a deficit, and that adds each year to the total debt. It's that total debt that has a ceiling. And because Congress has put in place policies that create an annual deficit and the debt keeps rising, we bump up against that debt limit every so often. The current debt limit of about $31.4 trillion was put in place in late 2021, and we're now bumping up against that limit.
And just to clarify, this debt ceiling, when we increase the limit, we're not saying we are now spending more money. It's we're paying off the money and the debts that we've already accumulated. Do I have that right?
That's exactly right. Each year, Congress passes some annual bills that affect spending and also has in place some longer term policies on spending and on taxation. So that each year, that combination of spending and revenue policies produces a deficit, or in theory, a surplus. But when it's a deficit, it adds to the debt. We usually have a debt, and that means, a deficit. And so that means the debt keeps increasing. And it does mean that Congress has to increase the debt limit on a regular basis. Of course, they could take another strategy. They could get rid of the debt limit and just live with the spending and revenue policies. But over the decades, they've chosen to keep a debt limit in place.
What is the or what? If Congress doesn't agree to bump up the debt ceiling and eventually we stop being able to pay these debts, we haven't experimented with this before. What are the thoughts as to what happens next?
Well, most economists think that the consequences are really very, very serious. Effectively, the Treasury Department could no longer borrow money to cover government obligations. And we usually call that simply a default, failing to pay off your credit card on time. And those who hold the debt, bondholders, or people who expect the government to pay them, many vendors, government employees, including military employees, they might find themselves in a very bad circumstance because the Treasury Department cannot live up to its obligations to them. If the Treasury Department can no longer borrow, then it's going to have to take some fairly drastic steps. That's where things get a little iffy. We've never really truly tested this. In 2011, there was a threatened breach of the debt limit, threatened default, and that was enough to cause a plunge in stock prices, an increase in interest rates, a downgrading of the federal government's credit rating, a sharp spike in mortgage interest rates, and it created big losses. It made interest rates go up. It meant funding the existing debt even more expensive, and it greatly harmed the economy. There are various estimates on this, but it surely cost the economy over the next 10 years a couple of percentage points in productivity.
Talking to Steve Smith from Washington University, looking at the debt ceiling. The clock starts in effect tomorrow. We hit that debt ceiling. There's some wiggle room, the Treasury Department says. Probably by June, though, something has to give. Should it? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree that Republicans should use their leverage over the debt ceiling to get some changes in the way the federal government spends money? If so, what would you like to change? Or is there another time and place to have this debate? Call in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Steve, let's turn to the politics now surrounding the debt ceiling. It seems like, correct me if I'm wrong, there weren't really politics. This is just something that Congress did. Then they'd fight about appropriations bills. When did this start being seen as a tool to get concessions?
Well, it's long been somewhat difficult to increase the debt limit. Members of Congress really don't like to be voting in favor of what might appear to be an endorsement of even more debt on the part of the federal government. But in the last 15 years or so, a group of Republicans, the most conservative Republicans primarily, have decided that opposing an increase in the debt made political sense for them. Some of them made their support for an increase in the debt limit conditional on big changes in federal spending. In 2011, that led to a bit of a crisis because there was an impasse between the Obama administration, of course, the Democrats, and the Republican Congress. Even the threat of default really created some substantial harm to the economy and cost the federal government hundreds of thousands of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars over the course of the next year or two. So it's considered to be very, very serious. But today's kind of radical Republicans say that a default is worth taking a risk on, that we really must make deep cuts in federal programs. And the only way to get a Democratic Senate and a Democratic president to agree to that is to threaten Armageddon, that is, threaten default. And so they're urging their leadership to go to the mat on this, to go farther than Republicans did in 2011, not to give in eventually. And this is going to create some turmoil among House Republicans, who at this very moment must be discussing their options and trying to come up with proposals that would allow the party to rally behind some strategy in dealing with the Democrats.
Now we see, as you mentioned, Republicans in the House, some of them saying, let's do this debt ceiling thing, get this leverage. The White House, the Biden administration so far saying, this is not really a negotiable thing. If we have to pay our debts, we have to increase the debt ceiling. Now is not the time. I mean, do you see either of those arguments giving? Do you see a prospect for actual negotiations on this?
Well, there is room for negotiation. But it's not obvious who's going to give or give first or take the first step toward meaningful discussions. It might take someone like Senator Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate Republicans, to serve as a go-between between the Democratic president and the House Republicans to try to find some ground for a compromise. There are many, many ways in which they could compromise. They could find a set of budget agreements, some say caps on federal spending that are modest enough to gain the support of at least some Democrats and maybe the White House. They could simply suspend the debt limit. There's nothing that says there has to be one. They could simply pass legislation to suspend it, maybe just temporarily, while they're considering spending and tax bills this year. So there are all kinds of ways to come up with a compromise on fiscal policy. But in the end, you still need a majority in both the House and the Senate in order to avoid default. And it's not obvious yet who's going to even make the first move, let alone what the outcome will be.
We're talking about the national debt limit, the debt ceiling you may be seeing in the headlines, which Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says the U.S. is projected to reach tomorrow. We've got some months of wiggle room thanks to some funky accounting. Steve Smith is with us, professor of political science at Washington University. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the House Republican side of things? Many House Republicans saying, yes, let's not increase this debt ceiling limit unless we can get some spending concessions out of the White House. Good idea, bad idea? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Steve Smith, professor of political science at Washington University, looking at the politics and policy around Congress and the national debt limit to prevent the U.S. from defaulting on its financial obligations. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions about the debt ceiling, the national debt, federal spending. 800-642-1234 is the number. Doug joins us now in Colfax. Doug, hi.
Hi, I have a question about percent of GDP of our national debt. Is it really much greater than it has been in the past, or is it, and therefore is it a real significant problem for the functioning of our federal government, or is it more of a political point-making issue?
Doug, thanks a lot for that call. Steve, the debt number itself, really big as a percentage of GDP. Doug suggesting maybe not that bad. A lot of economists and others have this argument all the time. What are your thoughts?
Well, Doug, it has been creeping up. It's been creeping up, not quite monotonically, that is year by year, since about 1980. That was the... In the 1970s, we were down to a national debt that was roughly 30% of our gross domestic product. And we're now over 100%, and it promises to go up to maybe 130 or 140 in the next decade. So it is creeping up as a percent of our gross domestic product. Some people use that as a kind of a measure of our capacity to carry the debt. Now, obviously, people with a larger income can carry a larger debt. But if the percentage of that of their income that is held in debt or is they owe, it becomes more and more of a problem. So there's no doubt that we have committed to a variety of forms of government spending. A combination of defense and social programs that has increased our national debt. And members of Congress who don't want to increase taxes to cover those costs then necessarily generate an annual deficit, which keeps the debt creeping upward. So it is true that we've experienced now about a generation of an increasing federal debt as a percent of gross domestic product.
Doug, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. I want to give another listen to Representative Mike Gallagher, a Republican from Wisconsin, speaking this morning on The Morning Show. Some of what he hopes comes out of this showdown.
What I would prefer to see is pairing a debt ceiling increase with something called the Trust Act. That's a bill I have. It's bipartisan in the Senate. It would basically set up a series of rescue task forces for all the trust funds that are going insolvent. I'd also be in favor of a reform to the process so we do budgeting on a biannual basis. My predecessor, Reid Ribble, led the charge on that. That would just make it so much easier to get budgeting done in a sensible, sober manner. The other thing I'd be in favor of is something called the No Budget, No Pay Act, which basically says if we don't pass budgets on time, if we don't do our basic blocking and tackling of doing 12 separate appropriations bills, we, as members of Congress, don't get paid.
I want to tackle that middle part there, Steve. Regularly scheduled biannual budgeting, and as opposed to this sort of what seems like an ad hoc system we've had for some years now. What do you think of that?
Well, there are many budget experts who think it's a bit of a gimmick, and yet others who think it's a fundamental reform that could help us a lot. Right now, the federal government operates on an annual budget. The federal fiscal year runs from October 1 to September 30. So every fall, we face a bit of a crisis about getting our spending bills and tax policies in place. And by moving to a two-year cycle, biannual budget, you can cut the crises in half. And but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to eliminate crises altogether. It just means that you have more time to prepare for the start of the next cycle, and politics can settle down a little bit for a two-year period. Many think that that's good for federal planning. Agencies will know what their budget is for a two-year period rather than a one-year period. And of course, the way the current system is working, we frequently don't get the spending bills passed until long after October 1, the date that the spending bills are supposed to be in place. This past year, they weren't in place until the beginning of March, many months later. And so really, the agencies only had a half a year of certainty about what their budget is going to be. But of course, it might help settle down fiscal politics a little bit, but it doesn't eliminate the need to worry about a debt limit. So it could be something that's added to a large package that includes a debt limit increase to make the whole package more attractive to some members of Congress, but it's no substitute for addressing the debt limit itself.
Talking to Steve Smith from Washington University about the debt ceiling and the national debt and the politics surrounding it all. Back to your calls now. Lisa is with us in Milwaukee. Lisa, hello. Are you there, Lisa?
It's Linda.
I'm sorry, Linda. We had a typo. Yeah.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call. I get very concerned that this is a ploy by certain members of Congress to trying to, you know, the debt limit to really start cutting into Social Security, Medicare, and Medicare. I'd like to hear your guests' comments on this, please.
Lisa, thanks for the call. If we had that debt ceiling drop, yeah, Steve, the impact on those programs.
Well, there were very conservative Republicans who are demanding that the Republican Party in Congress and the House go to the mat on extracting concessions from the Democrats as a condition for passing a debt limit increase. They're quite open about their hope to radically change the federal government's major mandatory programs. These are programs where the law states that you're due certain benefits if you meet certain conditions, like age. So Medicare, Social Security, or income requirements that make you eligible for Medicaid, the large federal health program. And they're not shy about saying that they want major deep cuts in these programs. Moreover, they will be quite open about wanting to fundamentally change the role of the federal government in American life, reducing its role very substantially and the tax burden that comes with it. So there's no doubt that that's their intention. It's not a hidden strategy. They're quite out in the open about this. Now, maybe a generation ago, decades ago, they would have been more quietly advocating these changes. But today's far right in the House Republican Party is very open about their hope to radically change those major federal social programs.
Lisa, thanks for that call. Time for one more caller with, Linda, thanks for that call. Anne joins us now in Madison. Anne, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate what your guest says about if we don't raise the debt ceiling and default on our loans, how horrible that will be for our economy. But I feel like I've heard this multiple times. It seems like at least once or twice a year we hear that we're going to default on our loans. And I'm just wondering your guest's thoughts on how sustainable this is for us to continue to pass budgets at a deficit and then continue to raise the debt ceiling, and that without having some type of plan or problem solving in place to rectify that.
Thanks for the call. We're just about out of time. It's a great question for our last minute, Steve.
Well, I think it is crazy for us to have a debt limit. I'll be honest that I think what's critical is that we make smart spending and revenue or tax decisions. Once we make those spending and tax decisions, I think we're obligated then to cover the borrowing, if that's what they imply. We have a legal obligation, I think a moral obligation, and it only makes economic sense that we pay our bills. So the real question is how we can reform fiscal policy so that we're on a better long-term plan. And that's where politics comes in. But it's not mere politics. It's real differences about the role of government in American life. And the Democrats and Republicans are simply very far apart those very priorities. And now we have one House of Congress controlled by the Republicans, the other one, and the White House controlled by the Democrats. We simply can't expect the two sides to easily agree.
And that's where we'll leave it. Thanks to our guest, Steve Smith from Washington University, looking at the latest standoff over the debt ceiling and whether Congress is going to raise it or not in the next few months. Yesterday, we listened back to a conversation about kid culture, the lore of childhood, the games, songs, rhymes, and more that get passed on from generation to generation. You shared some more of your memories. Carlene remembers a game called Mosquito, which is like freeze tag, but cooperative. When the mosquito bit you, you were frozen. The other kids would have to surround you holding hands to unfreeze you. Patty remembered a couple games. One is called Statue Maker. It's a twist on that sort of freeze tag. The other one, Fox and Pies. The fox would visit the swing set where the pies were, and guess what type of pie you were? If the fox guessed correctly, the pie had to run from the swing set and try to get caught or eaten by the fox. Pies. And Ron is in a children's band called the Teddy Bear Band, marking their 38-year anniversary in a couple months. He says that we remember these songs because of the way they made us feel when they were new to us, and that's a feeling we never want to forget. Thanks for those memories. I think we need to start up a competitive Central Time mosquito team, or maybe Red Rover. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a member of a public health advocacy group called the People's CDC, which says official COVID guidelines aren't doing enough to protect people who are at risk. Now, researchers at UW-Madison are testing lab-made retinal cells in a long-term effort to treat vision loss. They've just released new findings published this month in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that show they've overcome a big hurdle in that process. Dr. David Gamm is a UW-Madison ophthalmology professor, a pediatric ophthalmologist, and director of the McPherson Eye Research Institute. Dr. Gamm, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with a key character here, these retinal cells. You're working on making some. What's going on?
So this is work that we started about 15 years ago, building off of stem cell technology that was originally founded here at UW-Madison through Jamie Thompson's work. We use a type of pluripotent stem cell known as iPS cells, or induced pluripotent stem cells. which are derived from either skin cells or blood cells from individuals. And we developed a method and patented it here through the university to direct those cells to retinal tissue. So very small tissues about the size of a large pinhead that have all the different cell types that are found in a human retina. And then the question became from there, what can we do with that?
And let's talk about that before we get into kind of the multi-step process. What are your hopes for these skin cells turned stem cells turned retinal cells?
It's twofold. So there's a lot we can do with these structures in the laboratory. So we can use them to learn more about why people go blind from retinal diseases, and then to develop pharmacologic therapies or gene therapies to try to protect those retinas before they degenerate and people lose vision. But if we're too late for that, if somebody is later on in their disease, they've already undergone substantial cell death in their retina, then really the only place that they can turn is to try to replace those cells. And our central nervous system, our brain and our retina can't do that on its own. And so having these small structures provides a source of spare parts. And we've spent the last 10 years showing that these spare parts are very authentic. So they can do the complex jobs of our rods and cones and photoreceptors that we have in our own eye. And then the next hurdle became installation. So if we can make the spare parts, can we get them to where they're needed? And if we do so, do they have a chance of hooking up to the cells that still remain?
And that's this newest research published just this month. You've got these retinal cells. They appear to be doing the jobs of retinal cells. Do they play well with others? Can you share some of those findings in this new report?
It's a great way to say, you know, can they play in the sandbox with everybody else? And that's an important point, because these are fresh, brand new, right out of the wrapper, healthy cells that we're trying to put into a diseased environment in a much older individual. And so it has to do a couple of things. So the neurons in the retina, like in the brain, have to reach out or form what are called axons or cables or wires, touch the neighbors that they need to interact with, and then kind of shake hands with them or form what are called synapses. And so we've shown that the cells are authentic. We've shown that they can extend their arm to shake hands. But to this point, prior to the study, no one had really shown that they have the capability of actually making those synaptic connections. And that's what this study showed, was that they can do this. Now, whether or not they'll be able to do it in an actual patient, we don't know yet, and won't know until we start clinical trials.
Now, the science here is interesting. The way you showed that they established a connection, if I'm reading this right, this is something you couldn't do in a patient. You could do it in a test tube, in a petri dish. You used rabies?
Yeah, so there's a lot of things that are scary on paper that we use as tools, very mm-hmm. powerful tools in the laboratory. So we commandeer some of the nasty things that various viruses and other things do to us. We cripple the bad parts of those tools and utilize the useful parts. And so in this case, rabies likes to travel through our nervous system. It jumps from one neuron to another across synapses. That's a bad thing when it's a virulent rabies from getting bit by a rabid raccoon. But if you cripple the ability for it to travel too far or to create disease and just retain its ability to jump across a synapse, and you combine that with a tag or a label that turns the cells that are sharing that synapse different colors, then you have a really powerful way of rigorously determining that two cells have connected to one another and shook hands.
Okay, we've passed yet another hurdle here in these retinal cells. What does it take now to get from here to we're trying these in people to see if they can actually help reverse some of this vision loss, to reverse the progress of these diseases?
Well, a lot of steps, and thankfully we're through a lot of them. So it's one thing to be able to do it in a laboratory. It's another thing to be able to grow these same retinal structures and extract the cell types necessary to treat patients in large scale, in a system that's safe and sterile. And that required a combined effort between my laboratory and two Madison-based companies, Opsis Therapeutics and Fujifilm Cellular Dynamics International, who are both located here in Madison. And over the course of the past 5 years, we've gotten that cell manufacture part down so that we can make billions of these cells in a safe manner. We then have to test them, and then we have to go ahead and develop a clinical trial. And to do that, we've also partnered with two other companies, Blue Rock Therapeutics in Boston and Bayer AG in Germany. So this really is an international effort that's centered right here in Madison. And we'll hopefully seek to start recruiting patients in the next couple of years, assuming that everything goes well with the FDA and we obtain approval.
In just our last few moments, I want to ask about the other thread you mentioned earlier. You've got these retinal cells. The hope is we can use them in patients, but also you mentioned we could be testing therapeutics using these retinal cells as stand-ins. Is that something that's happening right now?
Yeah, and we have probably about half of our efforts in my laboratory are directed towards that type of activity where, you know, there's a lot of causes of blindness that we don't even understand. Children or adults lose vision for various reasons. And unless we know why they lost vision, it's very hard to develop effective therapeutics. And so we can study those people's retinas in a dish just by taking a skin sample from them. And then we can grow unlimited quantities of their retina, try to understand what went wrong in the first place or what's going wrong if they're early in the course of the disease, and then develop therapeutics that are tailored to those individuals. It's something that's very expensive right now and it's in its infancy, but like anything else, as the technology grows, it'll become more mainstream. And I think will lead to a lot of breakthroughs to help people before they need cell replacement, which is our ultimate goal, because it's better to keep what you've got than to replace what you've lost.
Dr. Gamm, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Dr. David Gamm, UW-Madison ophthalmology professor, pediatric ophthalmologist, and director of the McPherson Eye Research Institute. He shared some new research on the effort to create retinal cells that can be used as a treatment for vision loss down the road. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about one family's annual food tradition.
Deer hunting is a family tradition for many people in Wisconsin. But what do you do with the venison once you get home? As Brianna Ruppel tells us, her family in northern Wisconsin gets together to cold smoke sausage.
It's a blustery January morning, and four generations of my family have stomped the snow off their boots and reunited in a Marathon County basement to take part in an annual tradition.
Yeah, does anybody want coffee or a Bloody Mary?
Scattered on chairs, tables, even on top of the washing machine, are bowls of raw meat.
They're done with gun season, bow season, and everybody around here has venison.
Of course, these hunters could just take their harvested meat to a processor in town who will have it ready in a couple of hours. So why not skip the work?
It's a reward for a good hunt is what it amounts to, really.
That's my grandpa, Bob Schwartz. The technique they'll use is called cold smoking, a meat preservation method used by many northern cultures around the world for thousands of years.
The expert right here has been doing this for a long time.
That expert? My uncle, Bob Yonke, who continues to pass on the German traditions he learned at his family's smokehouse just 3 miles down the dirt road.
Oh boy, got to be 45 years ago, and been doing it ever since.
Yonke has modernized a few of the mechanisms from the old days, though they still have that rustic Wisconsin ingenuity. Now he's rigged up a grinder to a motor with a gear reduction.
You can see how fine it gets then. It doesn't get all curled up in the blade.
This is Bob's son, Scott Yonke, who was about 10 when he and his brother started learning from their dad. Of course, food traditions are nothing without the secret ingredient.
Everybody says, oh, this tastes good. How do you season it? Oh, we can't tell you. Just eat some more.
Throughout history, different families and butchers could be distinguished by their own unique blend of seasonings. Because the meat is not cooked to 160 degrees, it technically remains raw. Though smoke is both an antimicrobial and antioxidant, it's not enough to safely preserve raw meat.
You have to have some cure in it, otherwise you could get sick.
Now the crew will squeeze the seasoned and cured meat into 2-pound sticks using a stuffer initially intended to run on water pressure that Yonke has converted to run on air. Everyone grabs a stack to haul up the narrow staircase and out back to the smokehouse. In 1995, Yonke built this smokehouse out of cement. His grandchildren's tiny handprints from nearly 30 years ago still there in the floor. Generally, meat is smoked using hardwood.
Apple, cherry, and hickory.
Yankee stacks the wood in a small pit dug into the floor of the smokehouse. He controls the size of the fire by sliding a heavy iron lid to increase or decrease the opening.
This is the adjuster, how you regulate the heat.
The goal is to keep the temperature inside the smokehouse below 80 degrees. Yankee keeps a close watch on his fire, often checking on it 3 times a day. Nature controls the time frame, but Yankee uses weight to tell when the sticks are ready.
And when they lose 20% of their weight, then they're done. And that usually takes a little over a week.
Yankee stands without a visible shiver in winds that blow a rush of white across his land. He looks content in knowing the tradition of cold smoking will be carried on through the hands of generations to come. Surely they too will be taught the most secret ingredient of all, patience.
Brianna Ruppel brought us that story on cold smoking sausage. She's a writer who now lives in Michigan. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we talk to a doctor who's a member of a group called the People's CDC that says official public health guidelines have left at-risk people behind as the COVID pandemic continues. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Now we're taking a look at a group of medical professionals and activists who say the response to the ongoing coronavirus pandemic needs to be stronger. The People's CDC was established in response to what its members see as the government's failures to protect high-risk, immunocompromised, and other vulnerable people as the pandemic continues. One of the members of that group joins us now. Dr. Laura Germanis is a primary care physician practicing in Massachusetts, a member of the People's CDC. Dr. Germanis, thanks for joining us today.
Yes, thank you so much for having me, Rob. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Can you tell us a bit more about the mission of the People's CDC and why you wanted to be part of it?
Absolutely. Well, you know, I think that we're basically a group of public health experts, medical and public health professionals who came together over the last 3 years, observing increasingly major red flags in the way that our country is addressing the COVID pandemic. You know, basically our top three red flags in terms of the pandemic response are that we, as Americans, first of all, deserve honest and impartial evidence that's based on the science. And the CDC has not been giving us that.
Where do you see the CDC falling short? I'm sorry, where do you see the CDC falling short on that kind of that data that they're sharing publicly?
So first of all, the CDC has been downplaying the serious threat that COVID poses and does that in a couple of ways. First of all, they liken COVID to the flu. And then the other way is by creating maps that de-emphasize the risk of catching COVID where you are. And all of this, in spite of the fact that COVID has been the third leading cause of death in the U.S. since the pandemic began. So, you know, the way that Biden approached the pandemic when he first entered office, he had this plan to beat COVID. And then all of a sudden, in February 2022, when they had stated this commitment to making sure that people had access to tests and treatments and the tools to really respond to the COVID pandemic, then all of a sudden it felt like, oh, actually, we have this under control. So now we're entering year three of the pandemic. We've basically had about a year of this COVID is under control message from politicians and even from some medical professionals. And in the last year, over 250,000 people died from COVID in the U.S. I don't feel like that's under control. Many people, I would think, agree with me on that.
And your organization also talks about the current mask policy, which seems to be, if you're worried about yourself, then wear masks. You're hoping for something a little more than that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Look, the CDC's, and this actually gets to my second red flag, the CDC's emphasis on personal responsibility is leaving a lot of people behind. The pandemic won't totally be over until it's over for everyone. And that approach also devalues the lives of people who are at high risk. So people who are at high risk, actually, this is according to the CDC's own numbers, they estimate that 4 in 10 U.S. adults are at risk for serious outcomes when they get infected with COVID. And so what this you do you approach does is it encourages or it actually burdens the people who are at high risk to protect themselves instead of encouraging everyone to protect each other, which is the foundation of a public health response.
And that was red flag number two. What do you see as the third red flag?
Right. So the third red flag is that the people in this country have had enough being governed by the whims of big business. We can't allow big business of all things to dictate what good science is to the CDC. So we've seen over the last couple of years, the CDC shifting recommendations while kowtowing to business interests. The most or one of the most salient examples was when the Delta CEO wrote a letter to the CDC asking them to shorten the isolation guidelines from 10 days to 5 days. And then the CDC did so in spite of its own evidence that people are contagious for 10 days or more.
Talking to Dr. Laura Germanis, who practices in Massachusetts as a primary care physician, about the group The People's CDC saying the CDC basically let off the gas pedal, in effect, when it came to efforts to control COVID. What kind of changes are you advocating for, Dr. Germanis?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, first and foremost, I think as a society, we're finding that we're overly reliant on personal decisions and decision-making. And also, the basis of good decision-making is having good information. I am a doctor, and as a primary care doctor, I want to share the best possible science with patients in language that people can understand and in ways that they can act on it. But if somebody has cancer, I'm not going to tell them, oh, well, you know, you'll probably be okay. Just go on living and be happy in your life. I'm going to tell them the how serious the diagnosis is, and then I'm going to give them the tools that they need to be able to pursue the best possible treatments. And that is what we would like the CDC to do. You know, as we look at the U.S. And life expectancy in the U.S., when we compare life expectancy in the U.S. to other peer countries, other, wealthy countries around the world, we find that the U.S. actually systematically does worse. So our life expectancy, even before the pandemic started, was actually lower than in other countries. And then over the time of the pandemic progressing, we found that the life expectancy in the U.S. even plummeted further. So we actually had a decrease in life expectancy down for 2 more years and, below what we had been having before. And that actually also decreased more in comparison to peer countries. And all of this, demonstrates that in a pandemic, especially this kind of approach where you just sort of say you do you is not good enough. You have to really think about how to promote population health. And so as the People's CDC, we would really like the CDC and, local and national public health agencies to be pursuing more of an approach that allows everybody to have better health. And so first of all, we would like to see better information regarding COVID. So first, the information regarding COVID should emphasize 3 key things. Number 1, COVID is serious. Number 2, COVID is airborne. And number 3, we all need to work together to get past the pandemic. So first of all, this first point about COVID being serious. COVID is serious because it is a serious medical condition that is causing large numbers of deaths and is actually in the top 3 causes of death for adults and in the top 10 causes of death for children since the pandemic began. But on top of that, there's a whole lot of people who have had this experience of, oh, I got COVID once, I got COVID twice, it was just a mild cold, or I didn't have any symptoms and I'm fine. But the thing is, we're not talking enough about long COVID. There are a lot of people in this country, actually, a couple of CDC studies have demonstrated that 1 in 5 people who catch COVID, and even if it's a mild infection, can get long COVID. Long COVID is a syndrome that can cause blood clots. It can cause heart attacks. It can cause brain fog and other things in otherwise previously totally healthy people. And so that's something that I think the science is still developing on long COVID. We don't know all of the possible repercussions that COVID can have. And so as we see new variants, you know, allowing COVID to spread without any mitigation can allow more variants to form.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Dr. Laura Germanis, a primary care physician practicing in Massachusetts, a member of the group we've been talking about, the People's CDC, trying to raise concerns that we're not taking COVID seriously enough at this point. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there are a lot of diets out there. Often they don't work or maybe even do more harm than good. Explore the world of fad diets and why we use them with the author of the book, Anxious Eaters. And local governments around Wisconsin are facing budget problems while the state has surplus money. Will the cash flow to communities around the state? That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a philosopher makes the case that animals are beings, not things, and that we humans need to take responsibility for their well-being, especially when we cause them harm. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.